This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Anyway, I'm really delighted to be able to introduce David Daley tonight. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to read his book yet, but his timing for its publication is quite impeccable. Now that we are about 138 days and I think 5 hours away from the presidential election. So any book that in any way helps explain the current political landscape is greatly appreciated and needless to say, probably essential to all of us. David's book is called, and I'm going to say it because a lot of people call up the store today and they're going, there's an event tonight. And the book is like, I know the author. I don't really want to say the event, the book. And then on radio and TV, he's been introduced. The book's like Rat Bleeped, Rat Effed, Rat Fucked. I'm sorry. It's just called Rat Fucked. The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. And really, the subject is not so much about the dynamic of this year's presidential race, although it might be fair to conclude after watching it unfold over the last year that democracy is at some level being stolen or potentially being stolen, and that perhaps the title of the book does somehow apply to actually what we are watching on a daily basis right now. But in reality, what David is focusing on is the period immediately after President Obama's enormous triumphant victory in 2008 and the concurrent Democratic tide that swept Congress that year, and how despite that and what looked like enduring and impenetrable Democratic stronghold on American politics, the Democrats, in fact, have not really been able in the last 8 years to fully capitalize on those gains as expected, and Republicans somehow renewed their potence congressionally in that same time frame. This is a really fascinating book. It's extremely accessible. It's really, really interesting on so many levels, and I think perhaps most revealing and certainly cautionary as a tale of how a very savvy behind-the-scenes operators – and this is the really amazing part — with relatively small amounts of money. I mean, in the context of what is now spent on political campaigns, I mean, this is like, as David was saying earlier, chump change. Small, small, small amounts of money literally have remade the political landscape of this country. David is very well equipped to write about this subject. He's the editor-in-chief of Salon. He's an expert in digital media. He's also teaches journalism. He's been covering politics for many, many years. And he will be in conversation tonight with Paul Kane, who's also a veteran congressional correspondent from The Washington Post. And it turns out that they, I think, started on the same day back at, and now some of you may know, remember States News Service, and they started there, I think, on the same day several decades ago. Is that right?
Yes, 1995.
1995. So please join me in welcoming David Daley and Paul Kane.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We did work together at a place called States News Service where you were covering Washington for smaller papers around the country that largely did not have their own bureau here. And it was a crazy place that, on top of everything else, had lots of trouble meeting payroll. And in the summer of 1996, we endured something called what I called cash and carry summer, where we did not get paychecks for an entire summer. Instead,
we were paid so little it didn't really matter.
Yeah, it's $300 a week, which we all still remember. After taxes, was $230.31.
The taxes weren't being paid.
That's a longer story. But
he went to jail.
Yeah, weekends. One day in that summer of 1996. A new guy came in to work and walked over trying to figure out where he was supposed to, what he was supposed to do, what desk he was supposed to sit in. It was early. He walked over to this guy's desk and explained his situation, and I believe the response from Dave was, "Get out. Leave. You can go and never work in journalism again."
Was I that cynical that early?
Well, and Dave.
Good advice.
I think Dave quit later that day. And I'll be honest, 20 years later, 20 years ago, I thought we'd lost you from journalism altogether, but how did you, you know, how did you come to this book? Where did you decide on this book, and where sort of along the path of your own journalistic career did you decide to cover such an important yet such a myopic topic?
What got me going on this book was I didn't understand what happened in 2012. I didn't understand how Barack Obama could win re-election with 332 electoral votes, how the Democrats could take 25 of 33 Senate seats that fall, and barely budge the House of Representatives. I think they took back 7 seats. And the House remained the focus of obstruction to a re-elected president's agenda for a second term. And I didn't understand how that was possible. And I started looking into the vote tallies that year, and you realize, oh, the Democrats got 1.4 million more votes for their House candidates in 2012 than Republican candidates. And you say, well, that's interesting. But that's not a small margin. And the deeper you look into it on a state-by-state basis, you look at a state like Pennsylvania, which voted for 100, which gave 100,000 more votes to Democratic House candidates that year than Republicans, and yet the delegation is 13-5 Republican. You look at a state like Michigan, which gave 240,000 more votes that year to Democratic House candidates than Republicans, and the delegation is 9-5 Republican. A state like Ohio, which is always the bellwether state for just about everything, it reelects Barack Obama in 2012 easily. It gives Sherrod Brown a big win in the Senate seat. The House delegation leans slightly Republican. I think it was 51-49 as far as the aggregate vote, but 12 of the 16 seats go. And I didn't completely understand how it was possible. And I looked back, and I kept digging, and I came across two things which told me something had happened here. What I discovered was a plan called Red Map, and a brilliant Republican operative named Chris Jankowski, who runs something called the Republican State Leadership Committee. And what Jankowski understood that nobody perhaps in the history of redistricting completely got was how you could use this as a national strategy to essentially earn a veto-proof seat in state capitals across the country as they're redistricting, draw yourself lines that are essentially impregnable, aided by new technologies that had made it possible to just perfect this, and build a firewall in the House of Representatives for essentially the next 10 years.
So in it, you describe the process of this as packing and cracking. Without making everybody fall asleep too much, explain sort of what happens, how they draw every 10 years, how they draw these lines, and how packing and cracking has worked, and turns out that you get a 13-5 split in Pennsylvania.
It's a really exciting story. Gerrymandering is actually an amazingly exciting topic, for some reason, we all believe that it's the thing that put us to sleep in eighth grade civics class. These districts are the building blocks of democracy, and when we don't get the policy outcomes we want, these lines are often the exact reason. So yes, the Constitution mandates that every 10 years we redraw every state legislative district and also every congressional district. This has been going on since 1790. You can trace it back to the beginning of the Republic itself. Every state has a different way of going about it. In Pennsylvania, it's the two branches of the legislature and the governor. In North Carolina, it's just the legislature. In Ohio, it's an apportionment board. In California and Arizona, they use various kinds of commissions. So what Jankowski and the RSLC figure out is that so many of these districts across – excuse me – so many of these chambers across the country are super-duper close. In Pennsylvania, the state house, you know, two or three seats was the Democratic margin of control. So if you could go in and if you could spend essentially $100,000 here, $150,000 there – and knock out these legislators and take control of the chambers, and if you understood exactly how each state handled their process, you could essentially dominate it and not give the Democrats even a seat at the table. So this is what they do in the summer and fall of 2010. The entire plan costs just $30 million, which is, you know, nothing these days. I mean, Linda McMahon in Connecticut spends $100 million on two losing Senate seats.
Hillary Clinton raised $28 million just in the month of May.
It's $100 million more than Donald Trump has on hand.
Yeah.
But and they go into these state house districts where $150,000 might be the budget for the entire campaign, and they drop it from, you know, out of state, negative mailers every day for a month on these candidates who never saw it coming. And it works, and they flip all of these districts and take over. I think after that year, they controlled the entire process in 25 of 50 states. But the numbers are just amazing. I mean, in 2011, Republicans were able to have complete control of redrawing 193 of the districts. Democrats had complete control over just 44. Only takes 218 to have a majority. So that gives you a pretty good head start. The key is in what you do with all the Democrats in these states. And packing and cracking, essentially, is the way of going about it. Your goal is either to pack as many of them as you can into as few districts as possible, or to crack them and spread them out as thin across as many districts.
So I grew up in the Philadelphia suburbs, which is one of the states that Dave concentrated on. And to give you an example, I grew up in Montgomery County, and in the 1990s, it was almost a contiguous district, the Pennsylvania 13th, almost the entire county, pretty basic. But through the years, it has been cut and carved and sliced and diced, and Republicans took what was once a complete contiguous county almost. And if I go to my sister's house in North Wales, Pennsylvania, which is about 7 miles from the city line, about a 25-minute drive from Center City, Philadelphia, and I drive to my high school. It's a 5-mile drive that goes from 202 to 309. I start in Republican Pat Meehan's district. I go into Brendan Boyle's. I go back into Meehan, Boyle, Meehan, Boyle. I forget. I think it's 8 times I cross. And at one point, the highway, Route 309, is the dividing point. Tell us about how the broader impact then works through and what it does to sort of the democracy, small d democracy of it, of trying of how races are then run, for especially for Republicans who are in these districts.
I think that's one of the central questions. What happens in Pennsylvania is similar to what happens in all of these states. You cram as many Democrats as you can into, say, the district that Shaka Fatah had until yesterday in Philadelphia. And he wins by the largest margin of any candidate in the country. It's something like 300,000 votes. And the goal is to waste as many of those Democratic votes as you possibly can in that one district. And then, so the five Democrats who win in Pennsylvania win with percentages north of 70% in these districts, and the 13 Republicans win at percentages between like 56 and 61. So that's kind of the mastery of it. You can see the same thing in Michigan. I went out, you know, and did what Paul's talking about, and drove every, you know, all 170 miles of the border of Michigan's 14th, which is one of the most artfully arranged districts in the country. It starts in southern Detroit and some of the poorest neighborhoods of Detroit, and the goal of the district essentially is to connect the African-American voters in Detroit with the African-American voters north in Pontiac. So if you're familiar with Detroit at all, an 8 Mile Road from the Eminem movie, you sort of have it's a coiled snake of an S sort of at this district. It starts in Detroit underneath, and then you have an axis along 8 Mile, which is kind of the body of it, and then it rises up in a long, thin neck before grabbing its head up in Pontiac. And that long, thin neck is essentially one road if you stood on one side and hit a golf ball over. You'd be, you know, handling three different districts. The Silver Dome, the old Pontiac Silver Dome, is in that district. And if you were to drive from the old Silver Dome the 20 miles down to the new Ford Field where the Detroit Lions play now, you're in and out of something like five districts. So it's all about how you can pull together as many Democrats in as few seats as possible while then really neatly and artfully ribboning out the neighboring districts. And when you look at this on a map, it looks like, oh, that's a really strange-looking district, or that's a Rorschach test that I can't even imagine what that is. But when you drive them and when you see it at street level, that's when you see how purposeful each of these lines is, what they leave in and what they leave out. In some cases in these districts, especially in Michigan there, they found the very line between hope and despair, and they etched it into a congressional delegation. The schools are different on one side of the street than they are on the other. The homes look different. It's absolutely amazing. There's a small notch at the very northwestern axis of 8 Mile in the district. And there's one road that leads up to like a little cutout that resembles the state of Oklahoma. And if you look at it, you can't figure out what it is. Well, it's the town of Farmington Hills. It's a little small community, 10,200 people. It's a small, white, wealthy enclave there. They drew it up and pulled that out so that those handful of likely wealthier, probably more apt to be Republican voters would not be squandered in that district, but could be pushed someplace else where that they'd be more useful. It's incredibly purposeful, and the technology makes it possible to do this in ways that had never been imagined before. Folks have gerrymandered for as long as we've been around. What you're able to do now is different from any other kind. It's not simply politics as usual. The way we're taught, it's a real crisis of democracy.
Going back to my roots, I was asking my sister and brother-in-law, sort of showing them the absurdity of how the map was drawn, and I looked across this one little highway, and that's where the Democratic district started. And I asked them, I said, what's different about that neighborhood? It looks actually almost more successful, more fluent, and they didn't know. And I said, is that a Jewish neighborhood? Is that a slightly more? And they said, yeah. And I said, skews Democrat. I mean, do they have that level of data where they know they have a pretty good breakdown of church membership or?
From 1790 until 2000, gerrymandering was in its horse and buggy age. And in 2010, it sprints into a rocket ship. Think about the way you texted in 2000 versus 2010. There wasn't a keypad on your phone. You were using a number pad, and it took an hour to write a sentence. And the technology gets so much better between 2000 and 2010, and it's going to get even more frightening by the next time that this comes along. There's a program called Maptitude, which is used by all the strategists and all the map drawers, they're pretty much in every state, and it comes preloaded with all the census data. So anything you would want to know about economic data, about income, about religion, it's all right there. And then you can add on to that any public record data set. Map makers in Arizona showed me what this looks like. It's block level, precinct level voting results all the way down ballot as far back as you can remember. You can pretty much tell from this information how a street votes. And because our partisanship has hardened in the ways that it has, if you know all of this, you can draw pretty good lines. But then there's all the private information you can buy and then add into this, whether it's databases of magazine subscriptions or social media likes or buying purchases or anything else. And when you add all of that in, it's an incredibly powerful tool for deciding where these lines go.
Let's talk about sort of the impact on the Republican Party. Back in 2010, when I was writing a story about the early recruiting efforts, the Republicans loved a guy named Stephen Fincher. He was the gospel-singing farmer from Frog Jump, Tennessee.
Wow.
And he became the first Republican to hold this West Tennessee district since Davy Crockett. The first non-Democrat since Davy Crockett. And a year and a half later in Congress, Tennessee started drawing the lines. And I said, how'd you do? And he goes, I got five, six points more Republican. And I said, well, that's great. He said, are you kidding me? That's terrible. I got to worry about primary now.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we've done. We have made it so... So many of these districts are so safe, and I would say,
how many?
I would say 400 of the 435 are completely safe. And when you've done that, the only competition you see is inside a party, a primary. So it becomes a question of, I'm crazy. No, I'm crazier. And you know, that's your debate. You know, right there. And when we have so many districts where the only competition comes from who's crazier, you lose you lose the art of political persuasion. You lose the art of trying to convince the other side that you're right. You don't send people to Washington who have any interest in governing or compromise. You send people whose only interest is in protecting their flank. And when Eric Cantor loses, that only, you know, to a nobody, the college professor takes down a majority leader, that only, you know, scares people more, and it ties things up in knots, and you have an angrier base. You create the conditions under which Donald Trump can walk in and take the party. I mean, I think that the Republicans who launched this plan believed that they were doing something brilliant, and they were, but they possibly outsmarted themselves. They locked in control of the House for a decade, but they lost control of their own caucus as a result. I mean, John Boehner is essentially taken down by a North Carolina congressman named Mark Meadows, who represents the, you know, somehow represents the funky vegan cafe and indie bookstore town of Asheville, in addition to all of the western North Carolina mountain towns out there. And Meadows comes into office in 2012 on these new maps. He ran a sandwich shop. He ran a campaign in which he promised he was going to send the president back to Kenya. And he wins. This district had been represented by Heath Shuler, who we may know as a congressman, may know as a quarterback for the Redskins back in the day.
They don't like talking about Heath Shuler.
Probably not.
Bad record with the Redskins.
Shuler's a conservative Democrat, and he takes one look at these new lines and says, I can't win in this district. I'm done. He retires, becomes an energy lobbyist. Probably still a better energy lobbyist than a quarterback. but he... and Meadows takes this district, and it's Meadows who files the parliamentary motion last fall that essentially leads to Boehner's resignation. You get the House Freedom Caucus when you have districts where the only way to run is further and further to the right. And these districts that they drew, that the first elections were run on in 2012, that elected Republicans are whiter than the rest of the country, that they're more conservative than the rest of the country. They're very artfully drawn, and it's a very dangerous thing, that the goal is figuring out a way to govern from the minority instead of finding a way to build coalitions and persuade people of the rightness of your positions.
Okay, this is going to be my last question. So everybody, you know, if you want to ask questions, line up, put your hand up. Dave will call on you. All right, Heath Shuler takes a look and immediately, you know, retires. Those southern districts in particular are just eviscerated. Do they give up or not, Democrats? I was at the retreat, their getaway in Baltimore, and Joe Biden was talking to House Democrats and was just kept saying, get up, man. We can win back the majority. We can. And 180 faces out in the crowd, the members of the Democratic caucus, didn't even applaud when Biden said that. They just kind of nodded. What are they doing, and what can they do to try and to win back the majority, or is it impossible?
The Democrats deserve every bit of what has happened to them in some ways for the catastrophic strategic failure that they exhibited in 2010. This, despite the word secret in the subtitle, was not exactly a secret. I mean, Karl Rove announces in March of 2010 exactly what the play is going to be he writes an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and says, when you draw the lines, you make the rules, and we are going to go to Round Rock, Texas, and West Lafayette, Indiana, and we're going to win these small townhouse races, and then we are going to redistrict Congress. And the Democrats did what? They didn't have the strategic imagination to come up with the idea. They didn't even have the ability to play defense once it was published in the Wall Street Journal in flashing neon lights. So it was a disaster on their part. And I don't see them doing anything to come out of this. I mean, they talk a good game right now about a plan called Advantage 2020, which is going to be their redistricting play. But this takes... You can't simply take back Congress and undo this. You have to take back state legislatures. You have to go state by state and undo what has been done. And it's an incredibly lengthy and time-consuming and expensive process. And it can't be done easily or without a real concerted effort. It's a popular headline this week to write stories that, oh, maybe if Trump is a disaster, the Democrats can take back the House. It's not going to happen. Enough conventional wisdom has been upended this year, but when I make this prediction, it's not a speculation. These maps are designed state by state. These maps are algorithmically and very complicatedly designed. I've seen all the indexes. They're unbelievable. They are designed to withstand a Republican evisceration, and they will hold. For the Democrats to undo this, they have to go state by state, winning back state legislative chambers and earning a seat back at the table. And they're going to have to do it with less money, with no element of surprise, and they're going to have to win hardest of all on these maps.
Okay.
If you do have a question, can you come up to the mics, please, so we can record your question? Thank you.
So, two questions. The first one is yes, no. Second one is more interesting. Wasn't this Tom DeLay's idea a long time ago?
Tom DeLay pulled off a brilliant redistricting of Texas. So, yes.
Even before it was extended to the entire country?
Well, this was a one-state play that DeLay ran.
Right.
Much of redistricting is left to the states.
Right.
So when the Republicans were able to finally take back the Texas state legislature, DeLay said, well, let's do a mid-decade redistricting. And truth be told, the Democrats had done a terrific gerrymander on Texas for years, and they were probably not outside of the lines of fairness to do it back to them. But, I mean, that's the play that gets Tom DeLay indicted.
It's a shame they didn't indict everybody else. The second question is one that you really sort of raised, that the Republicans may not enjoy what they wished for. Mm-hmm. Will that stimulate them, do you think, to make some changes in the lines, to maybe redistrict out some of the reddest parts of their, so they don't have to deal with the...
They've already announced Red Map 2. They're spending $125 million on Red Map 2020. They're going after Colorado. They're going after New Mexico. They're going after Kentucky. They're going after all the states they didn't get last time.
And they're not going to make the reddest districts less red, so they don't have to worry about primary challenges so much.
I would be surprised. I mean, the technology may get so good over that course in time. I mean... The thing that the folks who draw these lines now, what they're excited about are the ideas of predictive algorithms, which essentially is taking the same things that, you know, give you recommendations on Netflix as to what you ought to binge watch next. If you can create predictive algorithms that take a look at the census information, at the economics, and ask the computer to come up with, what is this district going to look like in 4 years, in 5 years? And let's draw the lines in such a way that maybe they look competitive to these silly Democrats now, but what we really know that they don't is what's going to happen here in 4 years.
So let me just a quick follow-up, because I guess I didn't explain it quite right. But is the Freedom Caucus going to expand?
I think it is hard to go for the number of seats that they want to keep safe without having it be the case that the Republican primary is the most important one. Otherwise, if you have a truly competitive election, it's not a safe seat.
And not and to yeah. add a point here, I'm going to let him do all the
sure.
You said, is the Freedom Caucus going to expand? Dave Bratt beat Eric Cantor and pretty much immediately joined the Freedom Caucus. John Boehner, there was a special election on June 7th. A guy named Davidson was sworn in 2 days later. His first act was joining the Freedom Caucus. They have both Cantor and Boehner seats right now.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me thank you. I think this is a quite interesting conversation. I come from a different place. I come from the Caribbean. I grew up in the Netherlands. So, I mean, this type of system doesn't exist. But your presentation leads to some questions, right? And one of the most important questions is obviously the surreal and strange and sometimes really abstract expressionist vision of these districts, right? I know that in some states, minorities have now started to push to go at the Supreme Court and to go in the court system, right? To say this way of doing it creates havoc for us, right? In a different way, we might have more representation in Congress than we had, right? Is this something that, for example, larger groups of voters in different states are saying, look, this way of redistricting is fundamentally anti-democratic. It is fundamentally not representative of the system. Again, this is built into the system, right? There's checks and balances, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to me that you can make an intellectual argument in in our probability, a winning argument in some of these court districts and at the Supreme Court. Maybe the problem of how the Supreme Court is now constituted, right, is a problem. But I think that the idea is that this is simply wrongheaded, right? That this cannot continue to work in a time when America is moving in to a majority-minority society, right? Which can lead in that you have a majority-minority society, and that majority-minority becomes underrepresented, right? Which in essence leads to revolution. But so that's the first question. The second question is just as important because. You didn't touch on these issues. These issues are just foundational issues, right?
Yes.
Again, I studied in a different place. We asked different type of questions, right? This is an important question, I think. How do you see this whole process of this redistricting playing out? Do you see it as a kind of a way to guarantee to institutionalize neoliberal capitalism? Do you see it as an effect of the breakup? To a certain extent, the fracturing, not only in America, but this is very much happening in Europe now, right, where the great danger is that basically one of these days an openly fascist could become president in what country that I'm so-called part of, France.
Will never happen here.
Well, hopefully not, right? Hopefully not, right? You know what we're talking about. But for example, in France, if you had a few more bombs explode, Marine Le Pen walks into the presidency, okay? Mm-hmm. At that point in time, we in the Caribbean had to say, to hell with this, we're out of here now.
Sure.
But so that's another issue. The issue is the foundational ideological issues that have underpinned this, the growing polarization in America across the class issues, the way America has been constituted over the last 20, 30 years, have all of these things led to this big problem that we're facing now?
Yes. We are essentially the only democracy in the world that allows the politicians to draw their own lines, to essentially choose their own voters. And it is anti-democratic, and the power has to be taken away from them. The Supreme Court has been not particularly helpful on this issue. The last time the specific question of partisan gerrymandering got before the court in the Veef case back in the middle of the 2000s, the court did not want to get involved there. That was a Pennsylvania case in which voters were, you know, again upset that the overall number of voters in the state were going one way and the seats were going another. And what the majority said was, we recognize that partisan gerrymandering is bad. We just don't know how to determine a standard that you could adjudicate it by. So that has set loose a number of smart people and a number of really interesting court cases that are aimed at showing Justice Kennedy what that standard might look like. I mean, Kennedy essentially Scalia and Kennedy came down on the same side in shooting down the idea of partisan gerrymandering but Scalia wanted to close the door on looking at this in the future and wanted to say it's fine. It's just politics as usual. It is the game. And Kennedy was like, I'm on your side, except I want to leave the door cracked in case somebody can show me something that works. And so far, he hasn't seen it, but there's a number of cases, including one out of Wisconsin right now, which could reach the court as soon as a year or two, that you know, could be a possibility there.
Yeah, I guess my question is a little bit simpler. And
thank you.
Good. Okay. I want to know who's to blame.
Simpler.
We've read again and again and again about this phenomenal data analysis team that the Obama group put together that spliced and diced and analyzed and. All of the electorate and generated his wins both in 2008 specifically. You say, okay, the Democrats didn't catch this. Come on. I mean, these guys were on top of everything, right?
Except they whistled past the graveyard on this one.
Or was it the change of focus from the DNC to OFA and the stripping of funds from OFA? And does it now come back the other way? And if so, what kinds of funds would you need to bring back? That's an easy question, I know.
Obama in 2008 revolutionizes the way you use data in political campaigns. It allows him to micro-target the pieces of the electorate and turn out and, you know, an entirely new coalition. And I don't know if the Democrats simply got complacent after 2008 and believed that they had this coalition of the ascendant that was going to be impossible to defeat. If they looked at I can't explain it.
You got these guys there who are every single district, every single ward, every single
except
block,
they weren't.
And,
except they weren't. I mean, Tom Reynolds, a really smart Republican, who, yeah, they plain out got skunked.
We got the answer. Good.
In the state houses, they did a terrific job at running national campaigns, and Democrats do a great job turning out the vote in presidential years. They do a lousy job turning out the vote in midterms. You saw it again in 2014. Why that's the case? I mean, it's
To use Pennsylvania.
Doesn't make any sense.
To use Pennsylvania as an example, if this is a really crude map of Pennsylvania, you've got Philadelphia and the surrounding suburbs right here, and Pittsburgh, Allegheny County out there. What David Plouffe and Mitch Stewart and the Obama team mastered was ginning up the turnout in those seven counties and not the other 55. And that's how they win statewide in Pennsylvania. Ed Rendell, Bobby Casey, Barack Obama, and probably Hillary Clinton again. But they don't then help the Democratic candidate who's running in Chester County.
But they pulled money away from the Democratic Party, the DNC, to put it into the OFA effort, to put it into this room or whatever it is where they had all the guys.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So if we could go to this gentleman.
Okay, this guy over here. To the left.
No, that's fine. So you've done a very good job about describing the situation and how we got to this situation. What I'm wondering is, what's the problem with it necessarily? Because it seems that gerrymandering, I mean, it's been with us forever, as including like some really convoluted gerrymandering has been with us even from the early days of congressional districting. And with the technology, the information, the tools, it seems that everything was readily available. It was just a matter of someone coming along and putting the pieces together, layering it and implementing it. And the only problem seems that it was the Republican Party that got to it first instead of the Democratic Party. So what exactly is the problem with this accurate, fine-grained gerrymandering as opposed to somehow pretending that this big data information tools and algorithms didn't exist in trying to force the old way of gerrymandering on us?
I think that all of these ways of gerrymandering are bad and that they're anti-democratic and they're wrong. And I say this not as a partisan or someone with my thumb on the scale, but to argue that when our political institutions become separated from the popular will, they're no longer effective or democratic. And I think that that is what has happened here, that these districts have become so manipulated and fine-tuned that we should all be angry and outraged about it, whether we are Democrats or whether we are independents or Republicans or Libertarians or Greens. We ought to be demanding fair systems in which the candidates and the parties and the ideas with the most votes win. I think that's when you have breakdowns in democracy, is when you have outcomes that don't match the popular will. And it's how you get insulated from popular will. And I think that the fundamental difference of some of the gerrymanders of the past and this one is that notion that I'm not sure it's been used before in quite such a way as to attempt to govern from a minority status. I think gerrymandering has been a tool to inflict pain on a political enemy. It's been a way to steal a couple of seats here and there that you might not fundamentally have had. But to lose by 1.4 million votes and still hold a 35-seat majority, to lose states by, you know, six figures and still have 72% of the seats, it seems to me something that as Americans and citizens we ought to say there has to be a better way to handle.
Thank you.
I think we have time for three more quick questions, those of you online.
All right.
One of the troubles is that we have too many people in politics who know how to win elections but don't know how to do anything else. At my agency, all the political appointees bailed when the big data breach occurred and just moved on to the next presidential campaign. It was quite a spectacle to see. I was puzzled as to why you didn't give Phil Burton a shout-out in your book. Phil Burton was the House Majority Leader from California who was literally able to sit down in his living room with a map of California and redraw the districts in that passed constitutional muster. There just aren't people like that around anymore.
I would have loved to have done a whole chapter on California. Phil Burton and his gerrymander was a wild, wild gerrymander. It's almost as good as the ones in Texas.
He knew every geographical detail about the state.
Absolutely right.
Shakespeare once said that gangs rule the world. What's the gang that rules the United States?
I'm definitely deferring to you on that.
You're not in a gang.
I should throw that one out to the crowd. I don't know if I can handle that one myself. The gang that rules the United States. You have an answer?
I have a question that might be the answer.
Well,
you gotta start.
Well, please help me.
Step on up.
Money.
That's a good answer. Money.
Yeah.
I'll be ready next time I'm asked that.
How much of this was affected by the Citizens United, and you know, are they looking at state levels for Citizens United type, the Citizens United people? Is that how they took over? Or was it independent of that?
They decide to run the Red Map play in the summer and fall of 2009. Citizens United comes down January of 2010. It certainly made it easier for them to raise the money and disperse the money back into the states. And it made it harder for us to track who's giving that money and where it's going. What the strategists behind this told me was that they had their play and they were going to run it regardless of Citizens United. And they had a lot of money from all of the big Republican donors. If you look at who's funding the RSLC, it's the Chamber of Commerce, it's Walmart, it's Altria, it's ExxonMobil, it's AT&T, it's all the folks who are... you can track most of the money that comes in to the RSLC. What's harder is tracking the money that's coming in to the states, especially North Carolina, where there's a lot of Koch money that going in. Michigan as well, it's a lot of ALEC money, a lot of Citizens for Prosperity money. A lot of that money is coming up from Alabama and Florida, and it's being sent into the RSLC, and they're pushing it back out in other various ways. And there comes a point when you go through the papers that you start to lose the trail, and that's because of Citizens United, absolutely. Thank you.
So much. I just want to say that we have plenty of copies of the book up front. If you haven't had a chance to get it, Dave will be happy to sign. And please join me in thanking you both for a wonderful event. Thank you for coming tonight.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.